As she drew the Thorn of the Rose and blocked the swing of a Psycor stun rod with it, Utanatenja reflected that she had definitely had better days. On the other hand, a pitched battle with stun rod-wielding enforcement officers in the Alden Great Hall was certainly a fittingly dramatic thing to be going on in the headquarters of the Duelist Society. If Tskaya were here, he'd probably be inspired to paint the scene. We can handle these guys, Caitlin observed, and there was no bravado about it. The statement was an honest assessment of their chances. You guys get to the loading dock. Amanda nodded, her katail in one hand, and hustled Devlin and Liza toward the rear doors while Sayanji guarded their back. As another gray-clad officer jumped down from the stage to occupy Sayanji's attention, Amanda's was focused almost entirely on the doors. Just get outside, and the others could disentangle themselves and follow. They could still get out of this. The doors opened, and Roger Tremaine stepped in.
Oh, no,
Liza whimpered. Going somewhere, children? Roger inquired pleasantly. Get out of my way, Amanda snarled, or I will kill you. I doubt that, Roger replied, and suddenly Amanda's mind was on fire. She staggered, eye squeezed shut, and clutched at her head, falling to her knees. Amanda Dessler had been tortured by experts. Part of the Imperial Gamelon Navy's training program for withstanding torture involved quite effective live demonstrations, using such unpleasant items as Klingon agonizers and Doctari neural whips. Even so, this was the most exquisite discomfort she could ever remember having experienced. It was like someone had drilled a hole in her head and was now injecting antimatter into it. How long it went on, she couldn't tell. An hour, maybe, or a second, or a year. But suddenly it was lessened. Still agonizing, but now not anything she couldn't focus past. She opened her eye, levered herself up, and saw Devlin staring intently at the Psycop, his shocking blue eyes open wide and quivering. Amateur, said Roger, his voice slightly strained. You can't hold me, boy. You may be a P-12, but your training is spotty and your experience pitiful. I'm already sublimating your ego wall. You can feel it. Devlin said nothing. He only narrowed his eyes, a thin trickle of blood starting from his nose. Amanda knew a chance when she saw one. She raised herself from the floor, set herself, and rushed the Psycop.
What the hell?
Easy, man. It's just a cat.
Jesus! What the hell are we doing this for? We should just burn this goddamn building down.
That'd go over well with the local yokels, I'm sure.
Fuck the local yokels. It's not like we want the thing intact. The positron matrix would survive a fire that wrecked the chassis.
How do you know a building fire would wreck the chassis? No, Corporal, our orders are clear. Trash it if we have to, but they want the head intact. R. Dorothy Wainwright listened to the radio chatter of the enforcers hunting her through the abandoned office building and felt outraged growing within her. Her emotional responses had been getting stronger and more complex over the last couple of days. It was too soon to be certain just how much that had to do with her experiments with Miki Kaworu, but she thought it likely that there was a connection. She smiled slightly at the thought, then returned her attention to the matter at hand. They were getting nearer, but their pattern was widening as they swept. She would have to engage one, two at the most, and her path would be clear to the back stairwell. Miki hadn't called again. He probably had his hands free trying to infiltrate the area. She wished he hadn't come. Not that it wasn't nice that he was willing to come and rescue her, but the odds were very good that he would get hurt in the process. He was a human. Humans were fragile.
God damn that cat!
The sound of a plasma discharge echoed nearby. Had Dorothy been human, she'd have jumped in surprise.
Jackson! God damn it, stand down! This building's not exactly stable. You go capping off at stray cats, and the next thing you know, you bring the whole place down around us.
And you're such a lousy shot, you didn't even hit it. Fuck you, Templeton. Secure that shit, gentlemen. Let's just get the job done.
Dorothy noted the electromagnetic disturbance of one of their transmitters nearby, just on the other side of the thin partition wall, the one she would have to get past in order to escape. She edged nearer to the doorway, readying herself for action, and then rounded the corner. The enforcer pulled up short, his eyes behind his visor going wide with shock.
"Holy!"
he blurted. Dorothy's eyes narrowed as she saw his name tag. Jackson. "You're the one," she said, "who tried to shoot the cat." Roger saw Amanda coming and shifted some of his attention back to her. The pain sizzled across her synapses, interfering with her motor functions, making her stumble and nearly fall, and she saw the look of satisfaction on his somewhat strained face as she did so. That was a satisfaction he had not earned. Telepathic powers or not, he was nothing but a cheap thug, and no cheap thug was going to get the better of Amanda Electra Dessler. She gritted her teeth, gathered all of her rage, and threw it against the intruding thrust of his mind. His eyes flickered with surprise as she hit him back. Normals aren't supposed to be able to do that. And then she dug into her reserves of strength, raised herself again, and hurled herself forward. The blade of her katail bit into his shoulder. The pain shrieked into every corner of her mind. She shoved the blade deeper, twisting it, tasting his pain through the attack that linked them and drawing a perverse strength from it.
"Die, you monster!"
she snarled at him in Gamelon, through lips bloodied by the bleeding of her nose. Roger staggered, her blade catching in the bone of his shoulder, and Devlin took the opportunity for one final thrust. The pain left Amanda's mind entirely as the Psycop focused all his attention on Devlin. Amanda let go of her stuck tail, drew back her fist, and drove it into Roger's face with all the strength her rage could give her. He blinked at her as if surprised. Then he gathered himself as if to counterattack. Suddenly, yellow light washed over him, and he staggered back and finally fell. Amanda glanced to her side to see Lesser Mazinger, discharge bleed still crackling from his tiny optics, and smiled. Short help, she remarked to herself, was better than no help at all. Sionji finished relieving his opponent of his stun rod, knocked him senseless, and then hurried to shore up Devlin as the latter's legs gave out. Utena, Caitlin, and Wakaba rallied round as well. "Let's get the hell out of here," said Amanda, pausing only to put a foot on Roger's chest and yank her honor blade out of his collarbone. No one gave her any argument. They charged into the side hallway toward the loading dock, beeline for the panic-barred exit door with Wakaba in the lead, and she crashed rather painfully into it, rebounding unsteadily into Utena's arms.
"Ow! Son of a bitch!" she snarled. "Locked? It's a fire door!"
"It's not locked," said Kate, bending to examine the seam between the double doors. "It's been plasma welded." "They knew we'd come this way," said Sionji. "Well," said Utena, drawing Devlin's PPG from her pocket, "maybe I can blast it." The PPG made a small smoky hole in the door, but little more. "Or not," Utena sighed. Tiny Robo, his armor scratched and soot-streaked, stalked out from behind Kate, his little arms making a "stand back, please" gesture to the group. Lesser Mazinger directed traffic as well, doing his best to herd everyone back from where Robo stood foursquare in front of the doors, surveying them with fists on armor-kilted hips. Utena consulted her watch and raised an eyebrow.
"You guys," she said, "I'm not sure what Robo's up to, but according to his status monitor, it involves something called an atomic buster cannon. I think maybe we should get back."
They fell back to the far corner, where they could guard the entrance into this short corridor and still keep an eye on Robo without being right behind whatever it was he was doing.
Utna watched in fascination as Lesser Mazinger fell back as well, leaving Robo to his work. Tiny Robo spread his feet and braced himself, facing the door about 6 feet back from it. On his back, the right hand of his two aqualung tank-like rocket thrusters shifted, dividing in half. The upper half extended further upward on a track, then fell forward, lying over Robo's shoulder. A little armature extended from his chest to catch it. He reached up with his right arm to brace it. From the front end, formerly the top, of the cylindrical unit, a telescopic barrel extended forward a few inches with a servo whine and a positive-sounding click. Behind him, something that looked like a rocket's exhaust nozzle at the rear of the newly reconfigured cannon hissed and outgassed a tidy ring of white steam. For a moment, nothing happened. Then, wham! The doors, the frame around them, and about 6 inches of Alden Hall's brickwork on all sides of the doorway vanished in a brilliant scarlet fireball. The shockwave curled back, ricocheted up the hall, popped everyone's ears. Tiny Robo skidded backward 6 inches, the treads of his feet leaving sparking trails and deep scratches in the concrete floor. Then, retracting the cannon back into its original position on his back, Tiny Robo straightened himself and strode with magnificent, measured tread through the jagged hole he'd blown in the building's side to freedom. Utna and Caitlin looked at each other, dumbfounded.
"I'm going to have a talk with Corwin when we see him again," said Utna.
Miki Kaworu had never seen a grown man's flying, limp body knocked down a steel fire door before. But that all changed this afternoon. He sidestepped and let the unconscious shape of a Corps enforcer named Jackson tumble down the stairs past him, then grinned to see Dorothy appear at the top of the stairs, carrying in her arms, he noticed with faint surprise, a cat. She nodded to acknowledge him, but didn't speak, only ran. Miki stayed put, let her pass him, and then started backing after her. An enforcer appeared at the top of the stairs. Miki raised Utna's phaser and let him have it. Enforcer armor is designed to disperse phased energy as well as withstand physical attack, but upon learning that Dorothy's assailants were enforcers, Miki had taken that into account. The blast he unleashed would have vaporized an unprotected man. This one it flung backward several feet in a boneless heap, insensate for hours. On the other hand, a few more blasts like that and the phaser would be exhausted. It was only a Type 1B, after all. Retreat would be the most expedient thing to do. Miki hurried after Dorothy. The three freighters chosen to extract Mac and his classmates from Worcester had not been modified for blockade running. Nonetheless, they could turn an impressive bit of speed, and by the time the Earth defense grid was authorized for lethal force, the ships had already cleared the satellite perimeter. The only obstacle remaining between them and freedom was the local complement of Earth Force and Starfleet vessels, several of which roared through orbital space to intercept the freighters. Mac stumbled into the Forge's control room, too big to be a cockpit, too small to be a bridge. As Lorg's co-pilot muttered, "Signal away." Through the transparasteel ports, Mac could see three Nova-class warships with Earth Force markings cutting across their flight path from starboard. Even without a glance at the tactical display, he could see the interception point about 40,000 kilometers away. In just over a minute, the freighters would be under the guns of two Hyperion-class destroyers, and changing course to keep them out of reach would allow half a dozen cruisers and one of Starfleet's new Galaxy-class battleships to intercept. "So," he sighed, "we didn't get away after all, did we?" "Don't be quite so sure of that," Lorg rumbled, his face twisted into what was almost a human smile. "Metapoint forming, 357 Mark 008. As Mac watched, a vortex of energy sprang into existence just to starboard of their course, widened, and solidified. A cluster of ships slid through the metaspace portal, centered on two vessels outmassing the Earth Force destroyers, 2-1 each.
Even at 20,000 clicks, Mac could make out the brilliant white hulls and severe angles of Freespacer-built warships.
Never go in without backup, Lorg grunted. Now go back and strap in. Things might get a little ugly before we get there.
The tiny woman sitting in the center seat on CFMF Charlemagne's flag bridge had many nicknames among different people. Starfleet Academy used her as the textbook definition of the loose cannon. Her tour of duty as a rear admiral had earned her the media nickname of the Pirate Killer. And her earlier exploits as captain of USS Constellation, CFMF Defiant, and the Charlemagne had earned her another nickname, the Klingon Spooker. The Klingon code name for her was Big Trouble in a Little Package. The Kilrathi called her She Who Must Be Avoided, and the Romulans referred to her, poetically, as Go Around the Other Side of the Nebula. The person who inspired such respect among her peers, the same kind of respect a ticking bomb gets, scarcely fit the model of terror. She still held wild, drunken parties with karaoke and games at every opportunity. She followed the idol singer circuit of her homeworld Tomodachi with a passion. She was a personality prone to violence, not out of anger, hatred, or insanity, but rather because she had never learned the importance of moderation in anything. She took incredible risks, used excessive force, and gave every last bit of effort to anything she did. And if doing that meant acquiring a bad reputation, then Vice Admiral Ayami Nakajima, Commander, 2nd Division, CFMF TAC Fleet, and the 6th Carrier Task Force would just have to put up with it. Captain T'Pol's voice echoed over the Charlemagne's intercom. Metaspace jump point is closed. Secure for Metaspace. Task Force defense grid is armed and fully integrated. Commander Claire Lemno, IS Chief of Staff, smiled as she listened to her earbug. Admiral, Earth Force Captain John Sheridan, EAS Agamemnon, demands to know what we're doing here. Let him eat static, Aya giggled. Ooh, and now Earth Force General Carlyle is hailing our fleet, Admiral, Claire smiled, her cat eyes twinkling as the half-cation added. He sounds really mad. Aya smirked, brushing back her dark page-cut hair before saying, Put him on screen. Might as well get it over with. The main viewer blinked from the blue and white of Earth to an angry human face, tiny wisps of white hair clinging to the sides of his otherwise bald head. The thick neck bulged with veins as General Carlyle said, Freespacer ships, you have entered a temporary no-fly zone and crossed the courses of several Earth Alliance warships in hot pursuit of possible smuggling vessels. You are ordered to disperse your fleet and allow our vessels to pass unimpeded. Aya put on her sweetest, most cavity-inducing, cute face and said, Oh, I'm so sorry, General. Vice Admiral Aya Nakajima, CFMF 6 Carrier Task Force. We're performing trials on our new metaspace drives, and wouldn't you know it, we had a systems breakdown and had to drop into normal space right on top of you. Don't worry, we'll move on as soon as we finish repairs. Admiral Nakajima, you will allow our ships to pass through your formation. Stand down your weapons immediately. Aya put on her sad, sad face and pouted. Well, gee, I'd like to do that, General, but our automated systems are stuck in crisis mode. Our defense grid is fully active and we can't shut it down. So it's really not safe for your ships to get any closer. The General glared through the viewscreen at Aya. Is that the truth, Admiral? Aya smiled, and this smile was no put-on. You just can't fake that level of hostility. As far as you know, she said just a little less sweetly, I strongly suggest you not test it. The General grumbled, noting that the intercept ships had already slowed down to avoid collision, and with a curse he keyed open the intercom on his desk. Order the intercept ships to stand away from the Freespacer fleet. That's an order. Looking back to the screen, he said, My government will file a formal protest of this interference in Earth affairs, Admiral. File away, General, Aya said, smiling a bit wider. We don't mind protests. You might survive a protest. Nakajima out. The viewer returned to its view of the space ahead, centering on the three Freespacer freighters slowing to rendezvous point with the task force. "T'Pol, have the refugees beamed aboard immediately. I want to debrief them personally. And have Shran fake some problems with the metapoint generator."
"Admiral," the Vulcan's voice replied, "once we have the refugees aboard, is our mission not complete? Our orders specifically prohibit any possible escalation of hostilities with Earth."
"I've got a feeling something else is going to happen, T'Pol," Aya smiled. "I want us to be around when it happens. If Earth Force comes calling again, stall them. This task force stays put until I'm damn good and ready to go."
With that, Aya jumped from her seat and strode to the turbo lift, the doors hissing shut behind her. With the intercom still open, T'Pol sighed with resignation. "Humans are still unfathomable."
Caitlin and company, slowed down now by the semi-conscious burdens of Devlin and Liza, reached the wedge from the Daniels Hall side, only to see Miki and Dorothy entering it from the Morgan Hall side.
"What are you guys doing here?" Wakaba blurted. "You're supposed to be with the others, off-planet by now."
Miki shook his head, struggling for breath.
"He came back to help me," Dorothy said. "If you're trying to reach Amanda's ship, forget it. The Corps have almost a company of enforcers around it. They're expecting you."
"Damn!"
Wakaba spat. Then, blinking, she added in a puzzled tone, "Where'd you get the cat?"
"Freeze!"
barked a voice from behind them. They whirled to see a pair of enforcers standing in the Daniels Hall corridor behind them. They must have entered from the Institute roadside. Wakaba looked at Utena and Kate. They turned for battle. Behind the two enforcers, there was a rafter-rattling roar, and two huge hands clamped one onto each man's head, then slammed them together with such force that their helmets were crushed. They crumpled to the floor. Behind them hulked the Institute specialist in the Klingon language, and the faculty advisor of the Institute Duelist Society.
"Professor Krog!"
Utena exclaimed, delighted.
"Kai, the Society," Krog replied amiably. "You seem to have made these creatures very unhappy with you."
The Klingon scowled down at the unconscious enforcers, then picked up their weapons.
"Blaster rifles against swords. They lack even a semblance of honor."
He slung one of the rifles, then handed the other to Utena, who passed Devlin's PPG to Sionji to make room in her hands for it.
"At least now things are slightly more even."
"Do you know any other way off the planet?" asked Wakaba.
"None that are readily accessible," Krog replied. "But Tenjo here is of my house," he added. "The Klingon consulate in Boston will give us shelter if we can reach it."
Dorothy cocked her head. "Concussion mortar," she said, then cried, "Get down!" and dragged as many as she could reach to the floor inside one of the wedge benches. Krog leaped, with surprising agility for his bulk, over the top of the nearest booth, and Utena, Wakaba, and Kate dove into it with him. With a tremendous crash, something sheared the roof of the wedge right off, covering them in dust and rubble. Corwin knew he was dreaming, but he also knew that it wasn't an ordinary dream. He had these every now and again, strange echoes of the cosmic symphony that resonated against his mother's blood. They showed him things, usually snippets of the future, but so lacking in context and detail that he never understood what they meant until after whatever they foretold had already come to pass. He found them more annoying than useful. This one was different. This one was absolute in clarity, razor-sharp and photorealistic, as though he were actually standing there in the wedge at WPI on Earth. Or the ruins of the wedge, anyway. The place had no roof, the wall facing the quad was mostly gone. What the hell was going on? There was a group of people huddled in one corner by one of the wedge benches, keeping their heads down. Across the quad, men and women in black armor were grouping up for a charge, heavy weapons in their hands. One of the huddled people in the wedge stood up, and Corwin's heart nearly stopped. It was Utena Tenjo, the thorn of the rose in her hand, and a look of mingled apprehension and rage on her face.
As the black-armored figures began their charge, she lunged forward, over the shattered threshold of one of the missing doors, and down the stairs in a countercharge, her hair flying in a pink streamer behind her, as a defiant scream welled up from her throat. Behind her, the others, Caitlin among them, and Dorothy too, scrambled to their feet and followed, into the teeth of a charge they had to know they couldn't stand against. Corwin shouted for them to stop, but his voice made no sound, and then everything around him went white. Corwin sat up with a start, then jumped again as the heavy book slid off his chest and crashed to the floor. He looked around the room with wild eyes, breathing hard as if he'd just sprinted 100 yards or more. His heart pounded. He raked his hands back through his hair, feeling the concentration of sweat at his hairline, and lurched to his feet. Nall looked up from his pile of coins and said, "What's the matter with you?" Corwin waved a hand for him to be quiet, his other hand still pressed over his left eye with the fingers splayed through his thick black hair. He squeezed his eyes shut, concentrating as hard as he could. The brand on his forehead flickered, then glowed with a high-pitched keening noise that raised the little dragon's hackles. "Do you love her?" a voice behind him asked. He whirled in the featureless white limbo to see a man standing there, a dark-skinned, silver-haired man who looked little older than Caitlin, dressed in an elaborate white uniform with gold buttons and traces of blue. In its styling, Corwin recognized hints of the old school uniform Zutrina often wore. The man himself looked slightly familiar, too, but Corwin could not understand why. "What the hell?" Corwin wondered. "There's no time, Corwin Ravenhair," the man replied. "I asked you a question. Do you love her?" "Who?" Corwin asked. "The Knight of the Rose." Corwin blinked, was on the verge of repeating his question, then understood.
Yes,
he blurted. "Then go to her quickly," said the man in white, and he vanished. Corwin wrenched his hand away from his face, rose fully upright, said, "Shit!" and ran from the room. "Come on, Nall!" he yelled behind him as he pelted down the hall to the stairs. Nall took a shortcut over the railing and down the stairwell, landing neatly on Corwin's shoulder just as he got to the bottom of the stairs, and inquired, "What's going on?" Corwin ignored him, calling, "Dad? Kay? Dad!" He ran to the doorway of the den, stuck his head in, then dashed around through the kitchen and looked into the conservatory. Nothing. Nobody home. "Shit!" Corwin repeated. Then he ran back to the living room, grabbed his jacket, and yanked on his shoes, hardly breaking stride as he did so. The front door of 105 Morgan Lane slammed behind him as he jumped down the stairs and ran to the driveway. "Where," Nall inquired with a calm he didn't really feel, "are we going?" But Corwin didn't answer. Instead, he pulled on his leather jacket, causing Nall to slide down from his shoulder, claws grabbing at his sweater, then adjust himself so that he was looking out through the partly down front zipper. Then Corwin piled into his antique Griffin limousine, cranked the turbine over, and slammed the gear shift into reverse. "Corwin, where are we going?" "Can't take the wonder," Corwin muttered to himself, ignoring Nall still. He revved the Griffin up, let out the clutch, and slung the big black car into the street, then rammed it into first and tore off down the hill. "Too slow. Never make it in time. Metaspace is no good. Have to do it." "Do what?" Nall inquired, but Corwin wasn't listening. Craning his neck, the dragon looked up at his companion's face, saw the set of his jaw and the glassy concentration in his blue eyes, and left off interrogations altogether. Soon it became obvious where they were headed. Nall was very familiar with the route from Morgan Lane to Matthews Memorial Spaceport. It impressed Nall slightly that Corwin wasn't pulled over for speeding, given the fact that he was driving hell-bent for leather, hitting nearly 150 miles an hour on Highway 29. Never a cop around when you needed one. The Griffin screamed through the toll gate at the Matthews Memorial exit without slackening pace, setting off speed alarms at the transponder reader, but Corbin ignored them, snarling as he was forced to slow down for the sweeping left-hand turn into the spaceport access road. Corbin had a code that would open the fence to the flight line, but he would have had to stop at the gate for that. Instead, he put the pedal to the floor, and the limousine's armored prow smashed down the fence as if it were made of chicken wire. Nall made a distressed little noise and hit his head inside Corwin's jacket, but emerged again a second later, filled with a sort of morbid curiosity. They were heading for Hangar 17, where Corwin's father kept his personal starship, Dagger Disc. Corwin had a code for this place's doors as well, but the black-haired youth made no move toward the transmitter panel as they raced across the tarmac toward the squat silver building. Instead, Corwin reached to the column of buttons to the right of the video display screen in the center of the dash and punched one of them in, causing text to march unread across the display. Weapon select. Missile. Okay. Something in the Griffin's dash computer beeped. A bit forward of the windshield, squarish pods about 2 feet long popped up on curved tracks from the tops of the car's fenders, and a targeting reticule appeared on the windshield. His eyes narrowed, Corwin manipulated it with his thumb atop the gearshift lever, zeroing in on the rapidly growing rear door to the hangar. With great plumes of grayish-white smoke that whipped away into the car's slipstream, a pair of general-purpose missiles streaked from the Griffin's gunnery pods, crossed the fast-shrinking space between car and hangar, and blew the rolling steel doors to Kingdom Come. The Griffin slashed through the scattering wreckage, slewed sideways, and skidded to a stop inside the hangar itself. Before the car was even fully stopped, Corwin was out and running across the concrete floor toward the starship parked in the center. Nall clambered out of the jacket and up onto Corwin's shoulder, gripping the epaulette stitching with his claws, and looked back outside through the jagged hole they'd just entered through. Spaceport police hover cars were racing toward them, but Corwin had reached the side of the glittering silver disc that was his father's well-maintained hot-rod Corellian freighter. He held his open palm before the keypad of the main ramp's master lock panel and spoke a single word, this in the language of his mother. Open! His brand pulsed, and the hatch unlocked and opened. Not just open, but emergency released, dropping open unresisted with its own weight and slamming down so hard it etched a line of spall in the concrete of the hangar floor. Corwin dashed up, slapping the controls to reclose it behind him as he passed, and ran around the circular inner corridor to the little neck that led to the ship's portside slung cockpit pod. There he flung himself into the pilot seat and flicked switches, running the ship through her pre-flight checklist with a speed and precision that would have shocked him had he been an outside observer watching himself do it. Behind him, Dagger Disc rumbled, then hummed, then purred, as the power core came online and the ship's systems awakened. The spaceport cops were just entering the hangar when Corwin threw open the throttles, and the freighter smashed through the roof and hurtled into the sky with a deep-throated boom of suddenly red-lined ion thrusters. The comm system clamored for his attention. He shut it down, his face a mask of concentration. The sky turned gray, then black, as they left the Avalon pseudocontinent's atmosphere. He kept the throttles wide open and vectored around the pylon into the relatively open space of the Zeta Cygni Dyson Sphere's interior. Once he was sure he wasn't going to run into anything, he released the control yoke with his left hand and began plying the navigation panel on the bulkhead beside him. But not, Nall was startled to note, the hyperdrive quadrant of said panel. Instead, Corwin's figures were playing over the keys and switches of the red panel inset on that control board. Three scarlet lights on the main instrument panel turned green, one after the next, then pulsed in sequence. Corwin's brand glowed brightly enough to throw shadows off the taller levers and switches as he worked at the red navipanel, his eyes closed. Then he opened them, uttered a short request to his maternal elders, and threw the red and white striped lever next to the red panel down. Aya returned to the bridge, fuming. Claire, secure channel to all ship commanders and Colonel Ruhlker. A few seconds passed before a myriad of comm windows popped up on the main view screen, arranged in a very artful geometric pattern. "All right, folks, we have a situation," she said once the 15th face popped into view. "Focus sensors on the North American continent, city of Worcester, Massachusetts, specifically the campus of the Worcester Preparatory Institute." A new screen popped up on the viewer, a tactical display showing masses of humanoid life signs and weapon discharges. A tiny cluster of life signs were surrounded by three times their number, and a short distance away, large numbers of dots showing the bright green flux patterns of powered armor suits were unloading from transports to join the besiegers. "Midshipman Mackenzie has informed me that a small group of students, including the eldest daughter of Admiral Hutchins, late of the WDF, is currently attempting a rescue of the Crown Princess of Gamelond and her intended." Aya frowned a bit deeper as she continued, "It seems this was all started by the Psi-Corps. The future Prince Dessler is a rogue telepath and an Earth citizen. The capture of Princess Dessler, however, makes this a galactic incident and a violation of the Constitution of the United Federation of Planets. Under these circumstances, I feel justified in launching a rescue effort to retrieve Princess Dessler and whoever else is with her. I want to know what we can do in 10 minutes. Colonel, are your Marines ready for an open-air drop?" The response was a guttural roar. Wookiee pilots generally didn't allow them to speak standard, or that was the excuse they gave for not trying. The Wookiee's comm window popped up subtitles. "Ready any time. We'll grind those Psi-Corps clowns into the bark." "I'm afraid we'll have to dispense with fighter escorts, Aya," Fleet Captain Homare Nakajima, commanding officer of CFMF Wilderness, put in. "Our scanners are picking up literally thousands of defense satellites. Our corvettes would take heavy damage going in and out of that. I doubt our fighters would survive unless we take the time to clear out our flight space." "And do not forget we have a dozen Earth Force or Starfleet ships in very close proximity," T'Pol added. "I estimate a successful mission with odds of 72%, but odds of 60% or higher of losing 3 or more ships and 20% of our fighter complement." "We could probably disable the SAT grid by ion bombardment of their control center," Schwarz shouted from over T'Pol's shoulder. "That'd be an outright act of war, though." "And what do you call capturing the princess of a foreign nation?" Aya shouted. "A fucking grav ball challenge? Prepare for fleet orders. We're going in 5... Sirens sounded throughout the Charlemagne's interior, duplicated by the other ships in the task force. "Reflex fold signature detected," Claire shouted, dashing from her comm console to the sensor panel. Aya blinked. "Reflex fold," she murmured. "The WDF?" "Fold event in 2 seconds, Claire announced. She blinked, then shouted, "Great, Minmay's ghost, they're folding in under the first satellite grid." "Who is?" Aya shouted. "Put it on screen, I want to see this." "Sweet Jesus," Earth Force Lieutenant Eldon Mars blurted as his alert panel suddenly went berserk. "Where did that come from? Control, this is Observer 7. An unidentified spacecraft has just defolded at 0.73, vectoring for Earth insertion." "Observer 7, control," replied the voice of a command operator. "Did you say 0.73? Confirm?" "Roger that, control, confirm. The intruder defolded inside the lunar defense perimeter and he's headed your way. I make his vector 99/07, speed about, holy Christ, 250 megalytes. "Did you say 250? Blurted Aya. "That's right," Claire replied. "He's a Corellian, YT-1312 class, heavily modified. His IFF transponder's hot. Admiral, it's Dagger Disc." Aya blinked, then grinned fit to spray in her face. "Track him! Don't let him out of my sight. Now I really want to see this."